Drive Time on RTE Radio 1 with National Irish Bank. The bank that brought Danske Bank's international expertise to Ireland is now bringing the Danske Bank name.
Dermot Good is a health insurance analyst with Corn Market Financial Services, and he's here in studio with me. We'll also be joined by Dr. Brian Turner, health economist from UCC. Dermot Good, as Fergal Bauer says there, we still have a lot of questions. Just let me ask you, first of all, where do you stand on the rollout of a one-tier universal health insurance system? Do you think it is a good idea for this country and it's doable within the five-year time frame that the minister has set himself?
Okay. First thing, Mary, I would say I think Fergal has summarised the issues very, very well. I'm very familiar with the Dutch model, the Dutch universal health insurance model. And whilst it's a very costly model, it delivers quality healthcare and there are no waiting lists. So I suppose I'm in favour of universal health insurance with a number of key caveats.
One of those just before you go on there, the Dutch model is also based on private health insurers providing the packages to people on the various scales as the minister has outlined.
Exactly. I mean, it's interesting when the minister first set out his stall in relation to universal health insurance, he was benchmarking his model on the Dutch model. And I suppose the more we started comparing it to the Dutch model, now we've kind of moved to the German model and who knows where we'll go to next. But their model works, but it is very, very expensive. But one thing, Mary, if we're looking at a model where everybody will have to pay and we do not get rid of waiting lists, well, then the model is defeated before it even starts. Because at least now for people who are worried about waiting lists, they have a safety net. They can go privately and, I suppose, pay their way past the waiting lists, whether we like that or not. In a universal health insurance model like what's currently outlined, if there are still waiting lists, then you will be paying for the cover, but you won't be able to bypass the waiting list. And that would be a huge issue.
We're doing an awful lot. The minister has an enormous number of plans in place for the health service. The HSE is being abolished. Hospitals will be organised along a different system. But how feasible is it that he is going to have a ship-shape health service before he moves to universal health insurance?
Well, I admire his I suppose his plans and the picture that he's outlined. I would question whether this is feasible or possible even to do this in 5 years. Once again, in Holland, I think they started planning this in 1998. They implemented it in 2006. And it's only now, nearly 8 years later, Mary, where they're actually seeing some of the synergies. I mean, this year, for the first year, they will reduce their cost by about 10%. I think trying to achieve, this is monumental change. I mean, it changes the way all of our hospitals operate. It changes the way the health insurers, let's just say, provide their benefits, our taxation system, consumers, everything changes. And to do that in 5 years is a huge challenge. The one other thing, Mary, I think, and to go back to your other question, if you asked all the various stakeholders right now, the GPs, all the medical profession, the private health insurance companies, and so forth, if you asked them if they felt there was a culture, let's just say, of full engagement and consultation with a view to building a bigger picture, I think you know the answer. Yet the white paper, pretty much, that's what it says. We are going to consult and engage with everybody to build this fantastic new model. That's not what the current situation is. And I think people will be, I suppose, quite concerned that, let's just say, that they won't see that level of engagement. And that's why I think 2019 is very ambitious.
So is your suggestion that all of the so-called stakeholders these days will not get on board?
Well, if you look at what's currently happening, you'd have to question, let's just say, that the possibility that every stakeholder is going to buy into this. I mean, once again, I see what happens in the Dutch model and, you know, they have that. They've actually achieved that situation where the government basically tells the industry you have 40 billion to spend. You must deliver that set of or that those benefits and that quality of care with that 40 billion and they make it work. But Mary, I mean, there's loads of concerns here. The waiting list is just one. I mean, I heard today in one of the statements that they've said that the exchequer will be cost neutral for the exchequer. I'd love them to give a guarantee to Irish consumers that let's just say what they're currently spending on healthcare in 2018, that's all they'll spend in 2019. We obviously won't get that guarantee. The other thing, Mary, in terms of how they're going to, in terms of the compulsory nature of this, and Fergal quite rightly mentioned, there are thousands of people who will not meet the means testing criteria in terms of to get a state subsidy or full subsidy.
A full state subsidy.
They cannot afford health insurance. I mean, I'm talking to them every day. And I would also question that figure of €920. I mean, my understanding, the average figure right now for health insurance is between €1,100 and €1,200. And that's rising. I mean, next January and February will be a bloodbath for health insurance because those 20 to 40% increases will be facing every consumer in nearly 12 months' time.
This is the thing. Everyone is going to be forced into the insurance market. Are the insurers going to look on this kindly?
Well, I think the insurers know there's change coming down the line and they want change because the current model is no longer fit for purpose. And I suppose at one level, in a model where everybody will have to buy a basic package, there are opportunities for the health insurance companies here. And once again, in the Dutch model, where the health insurers, I suppose, have reinvented themselves, is that they compete very strongly on the supplementary packages. Mm. And those packages...
Explain that, because Fergal was talking about the basket. There'll be a basic basket, which we will all buy into, which will allow us that equal access. And then there's the extras, which we can pick and choose from if we have the cash to buy them.
Exactly. And I think, Mary, the older members, if I can refer to them as that, who have the higher health plans, they should be particularly worried about this because in the Dutch model, there are no public and private hospitals. There are no real private rooms as such. Everybody gets a standard package of benefits and you can't buy any higher accommodation cover as such. And that is community rated. Their supplementary packages, of which there are 3 to 4 different levels, they are to cover things like dental cover, alternative treatments, physiotherapy, health screening and so on, but not really to do with the core hospital treatment.
You see, Dermot, there are currently available to people in the primary care package, if you like. People have access to the likes of occupational therapy or physiotherapy or what have you, some of it in the home, some of it in nursing homes or whatever. Will they still have access to those services once we're in this new system?
That's what we just don't know, to be quite honest.
Or will they have to pay extra in the package?
Well, and once again, Mary, we don't know that. And that is a concern. I mean, there was a comment today.
How basic will the basic basket be?
Well, see, Mary, I look at these things quite simply. I mean, I hope the basic package will be very comprehensive because, you know, now we're looking at real value. But once again, going back to what the government statements today, if they are not going to spend any more than they're currently spending, if they don't achieve these efficiencies that the minister has spoken about in terms of real monetary savings that they can redirect into the basket of services, well, then the consumer is going to have to pay extra for the extra benefits that they don't currently enjoy. Now, there was a comment today as well in terms of that for the first time ever, consumers will have access to primary care. That's not necessarily the case. I mean, anybody, you probably heard me before, Mary, talking about these corporate plans. Anybody who has these corporate plans currently gets 50 to 75% back on their GP the cover. The problem is most consumers are unaware of these. Mary, for me, when I look at all of this, and as Fergal quite rightly said, this is 5 years away. I think to a certain degree, this, you know, you could look at this as a smokescreen. We have serious problems with our healthcare system that are going to stay with us for the next 5 years. And the one thing that nobody has outlined is, what are we going to do in the interim, as Fergal said, to, I suppose, support and protect the private healthcare industry so we have a decent platform with which we can then transition to universal health insurance? And that's a fundamental gap because rates are going to go up by between 20 and 30% each year between now and 2019. And that's not a nice picture.
Dr. Brian Turner is with us now as well. Brian, Dermot Good has been outlining potentially what might happen. And of course, pointing out as well, there's an awful lot we still don't know from this white paper today. But from what you've seen of it, are you optimistic that it could provide the framework to a genuinely revolutionised healthcare system in this country?
Well, it would certainly be revolutionary, but I think for me, looking at this, I think what needs to be a distinction that needs to be drawn is the terms universal health care and universal health insurance seem to be used almost interchangeably in some areas. And I think we need to bear in mind that universal health care and universal health insurance are actually two very different concepts. So universal health care is basically a system whereby everybody has equal access to the health system. So it's a single-tier system. Universal health insurance is a way of paying for it. Now, I would argue that you don't need to have universal health insurance in order to have universal health care. And moving to universal health insurance doesn't guarantee you universal health care. In fact, looking at the document that was published this morning, some services, and as yet we don't know what services will not fall into the universal health insurance package or be provided by the state. So for whatever services are in that category, the third category, not covered by either of those, there would be the supplementary insurance, which people would basically have to buy on a risk-rated basis. So those who can afford that supplementary insurance will get access to those treatments. Those who can't afford it may have to do without. So we may end up with a two-tier, or at least an element of a two-tier system, albeit for a more restricted set of benefits.
So, a different type of two-tier system. So are you advocating here that we stay with the taxation system but change it?
Yes, I think that would be more comfortable from where I'm looking at it from. I mean, I think a lot of the The proposed measures, such as separating out the purchasing and the provision function, you know, moving towards a single-tier system, making sure that people can't buy faster access, removing the financial barrier to accessing a GP, implementing Money Follows the Patient, all of these, I think, are positive developments, and I would welcome those. However, I think that we don't necessarily need to move to universal health insurance in order for these other measures to improve our health system. I think we could stick with a taxation finance system and actually have a much better system if the other measures are brought into play. And I mean, the interesting thing about the document today, they talk about in some detail about cost control measures under a universal health insurance system with multiple payers. Now, notwithstanding the issue of whether or not some of these measures are actually legal, and there is mention somewhere that they've talked to the Attorney General about this, but if they are legal, they may not actually be very attractive to insurers. Mm-hmm. But if the state wants to control costs, the best way for the state to do that is to remain as the main purchaser of care, as is the situation currently. If they devolve the purchasing of care to the insurers, then, you know, it's going to be a much harder job to regulate the market and control costs that way than it would be if they were the main purchaser. So I think that's something that I think needs to be borne in mind.
That's a point I'd like to pick up with you as well, Dermot Good, this whole question of the insurers particularly, and whether the state is going to be able to put the sorts of legislative controls around the insurers to ensure that the prices don't skyrocket and that they're the ones controlling everything.
Yeah, and Mary, when you look at, I suppose, once again, when you look back over the last 2 years and some of the statements from the department, I mean, they've continuously said, you know, they're going to take steps, interventions to cap, let's just say, rate increases and bring rates down. They have failed. If you look at what's actually happening, rates are continuing to go up each year by the 15% to 20%. I mean, and the government itself is not blameless in this, because like they reduced tax relief last October totally unexpectedly, and that led to increases indirectly between 0% to 20%. In fact, it actually hit the older members hardest, as they tend to have the higher plans. They changed the redesignation or the designation of public hospital beds from the 1st of January this year. That's going to hit the health insurers for an extra 120 to 130 million. And you and I will pay for that.
That'll be passed on.
And, you know, levies, health insurance levies. I mean, the levies are now account for nearly 33% of every family's health insurance cost. So my fear is that, apart from the legislation, my fear is that if there's continuous interventions like this, I suppose, and meddling, as the health insurance companies would call it, and preventing them, I suppose, from running their business on a normal commercial footing, there is a real risk that we will not have four health insurance companies in 5 years' time. There is a real risk that we will not have, you know, the number of private hospitals that we have, because, as you know, 250,000 members have left the system. They're 250,000 customers less for the private hospital. So I suppose if there was one thing that I would look for on the back of today's announcement, yes, it's great that we're looking at least at viable alternatives. And I take Brian's point, this might not be the ideal model, but we need to map out exactly what we're going to do in the next 5 years to protect the industry and make sure, you know, healthcare, be it public or private, is affordable to everybody.
Dermot, you talked about the Dutch model as well, which you're a supporter of, although you do point out it is very expensive. I saw figures today that the cost of that model has doubled over the last 10 years or so.
Yeah, once again, it's not a perfect model. I mean, what they've done now, we have to be careful here as well when we're drawing comparisons, because it's not a like-for-like model. I mean, their average age is much higher than ours. Let's just say their birth rate is pretty much zero, whereas we're the highest birth rate in Europe. And also, their basket of benefits is much more comprehensive than anything that we're talking about. So they provide very, very good health.
Is it the right one for Ireland to be looking at and potentially benchmarking itself against it?
Mary, the way I'd answer that is that there are elements of the Dutch model which absolutely are right and good, and we should try, I suppose, look at putting together a hybrid model with the best, looking at the best practices across Europe. One of the issues they've had is in terms of higher utilisation levels, but they've tackled that now by putting excesses of about €360 on every single policy. They also had an issue as well, Mary, where I think initially about 200,000 people never bought the health cover, even though it was compulsory. So they had to introduce legislation to, I suppose, compel those people to actually buy the cover. So they, you know, they've had their issues as well. The interesting thing from my point of view is that they will say it's 7 to 8 years later that they're only now beginning to, I suppose.
Just a final word, Brian Turner, to you.
I think, reading the document today, I think I still have a lot of concerns about the proposals on universal health insurance, in particular relating to the cost. And I cannot see how what the government are proposing in this document will lead to anything other than higher costs for insurance than people are paying now.
Brian Turner, Dermot Good, thank you both very much.